organisers for inviting me here. So it's really nice to be in Los Angeles. So I'm Stephen McDougall, and I work in a petroleum engineering institute, which is why you see a little oil rig in all of my slides here. And the institute's at Heriot University in Edinburgh in sunny Scotland. Now I'm going to talk about a model of dynamic adaptive tumour-induced angiogenesis, and I'll come on to discuss exactly what I mean by that in a moment. So I'd first like to acknowledge my co-investigators, Angelique Stéphanou, who's a postdoc who worked with me for a year or so and now has her own lab in Grenoble in France. She's doing some nice experiments on cell movements. Sandy Anderson and Mark Chaplin, both at the University of Dundee, also in Scotland, 50 miles up the road from me. So a brief outline of how I'm going to structure the talk. I'll begin with a little bit of background about why somebody in petroleum engineering might be looking at problems to do with angiogenesis. I'll then go on to look at how we've modelled tumour-induced angiogenesis. I'll begin by talking about a model that Sandy and Mark developed quite a while ago now, 1998, and Sandy will talk in more depth about that on Thursday. I'll then go on to discuss the discrete capillary scale growth, so how we track the migration of sprout tips, and then go on to look at an improved continuous discrete coupling through matrix and panel proteinases. And then I'll come on to the bit that I'm probably more comfortable talking about, because that's what I do day to day, is looking at incorporating flow into dendritic structures. So I'll give a little bit of discussion about flow in porous media, and then to tell you how I've adapted that to look at blood flow through the growing angiogenic network. And then I'll come on to the main thing I want to talk about, how we have a dynamically adaptive vasculature. So flow will be coupled with growth. And then we'll end with some conclusions and some future work. Okay, so what am I doing coming from petroleum engineering and looking at sort of problems in the clinical arena? Well, over about the past 15 years, I've been involved in looking at microscopic flows through rocks, so looking at the flow of oil, water, and gas through porous media. And we develop software for use in industry. So industry wants to get as much oil out of the ground as they can, as economically as possible. And what we try to do is we try to derive certain parameters that they can use in large-scale reservoir simulation studies, try and optimize recovery, and also interpret laboratory experiments. So day-to-day, we're interested in producing something that can predict and give something useful. So we're not doing modeling for modeling's sake. We're doing it so we can use it to benefit something. And this is the approach that we're going to take when we look at modeling the angiogenic process. It turns out that the underlying modeling framework can also be adapted to look at a wide range of problems in the clinical arena, and I'm going to focus today on tumour-induced angiogenesis. And the rationale is to use the modeling techniques, firstly, to give us some insight into the underlying physical and biological processes. So this is how we've used it in the oil industry. You'll see a lot of data from the oil industry. Experiment A says this happens, experiment B says something else happens, and then could be contradictory. And what it often turns out to be the case is actually they're both right, but they were just doing slightly different things. And I think this could be something useful to keep in mind when we try and interpret different biological experiments, that actually you might get experiments that appear contradictory, but when you try and understand the underlying biological and physical processes, you can start to pick apart these contradictions, apparent inconsistencies. We'd like to reproduce experimental observations such as we have them, and also suggest some additional laboratory studies. And we'd also like, ultimately, to use some of the insights that we've gained to suggest new treatment protocols. So, to briefly go over tumour angiogenesis. So this is a slide that I'm sure many people have seen a few times before. Simplistically, I'm just going to divide the process into three phases. This early avascular phase, where a cell continues to proliferate. We end up with a tumour spheroid of about a million cells and about a diameter of about 2 millimetres. It has a necrotic core, a thin proliferating rim, some quiescent region sandwiched between. And then eventually we get angiogenesis. So here we've got a mouse eye with a pellet soaked in tumour angiogenic factor. This is the limbus going around the eye, and you can see we've got growth of new blood vessels towards that pellet. This supplies additional blood to the tumour and leads to additional growth. And then finally, we could target something like invasion and metastasis, where little bits of the tumour break off and find other parts of your body to give you secondary tumours. So we're going to concentrate on the middle part. So we saw a bit about this yesterday, the angiogenic process. Essentially, you've got hypoxic tumour cells that secrete what I'm going to broadly call tumour angiogenic factors. So it's a very broad brush statement because there's a lot of different cascades that are going on there, but I'm just going to broadly call them tumour angiogenic factors, TAFs. And as these are secreted, the endothelial cells degrade a basement membrane of a nearby parent vessel, and the sprouts start to migrate towards the tumour. So this is additional oxygen supply. So as we said yesterday, every cell is within about 50 microns of a capillary, but this is the additional supply that we're looking at. We find the capillary branching tends to increase towards the tumour, and eventually the tumour becomes penetrated and we get nutrient supply to that. It's not straightforward as that, as we'll maybe discuss at the very end. You've got the tumour that's also evolving and moving spatially and temporally, and the vasculature coming in about the same time. So the thing's a very dynamic system. And so a simple schematic of what we might do is as a first pass model, and this is what Sandy and Mark did, as I said, in about 1998, we have this square piece of tissue, homogeneous at the moment, parent vessel at the top, a tumour surface at the bottom, and the tumour surface secreting TAF, and the early model is a gradient of fibronectin. It comes from the parent vessels bound in the matrix. And we start off with three peaks of endothelial cell density. So this will start the simulation, we'll see how those peaks of endothelial cell density representing sprout formation propagate through the tissue. And the early continuum approach used these equations, which I'm sure Sandy will go into in more detail later in the week. Essentially, equation for endothelial cell density has some random motility, chemotaxis and haptotaxis. We've got TAF, which is taken up by the endothelial cells, and fibronectin, which is broken down by the endothelial cells, and there's also production termed due to endothelial cells. And when you solve those equations, this is just a partial simulation, that the red regions are high densities and the light blue regions are low densities. For different parameter combinations, you can get different patterns forming as the endothelial cells propagate down the tissue towards the tumour surface. Okay, so that's the initial continuum approach. And then this was extended to look at the discretized form of the equations so that we could follow, track individual capillary sprouts as they migrated through the matrix. And the model incorporated capillary branching, anastomosis, so that's loop formation, and cell mitosis. And the two tumour geometries considered a linear TAF source, where there's a flat tumour surface, and a circular TAF source, which you'll see in a moment. And when you discretize the equations, you get this sort of form, where now we have movement weightings or movement probabilities for an individual sprout tip as it propagates through the matrix. And these movement probabilities have terms that incorporate the random motility, the chemotaxis, and the haptotaxis. And the simulation is as follows. You solve the fibronectin and TAF equations, you generate directional coefficients, you compute some probability ranges, you generate random numbers, and you determine the appropriate growth direction for an individual sprout tip. And as I said, we have branching, which is a function of tumour angiogenic factor. Loads yesterday, we saw it could quite happily incorporate heterogeneous tissue structure. And I'm sure that the truth lies somewhere in between those two approaches. We can have sprout tip and sprout joining, and have these loops forming. And this is going to be crucial later on, because once a loop forms, blood flow can begin. And that's going to affect, as we'll see, that will affect how the vasculature forms. So here's some sample results. There's the linear source down here, and a circular source, a small hemispherical source down here, and you get very different capillary architectures. the next step in the modelling was to explicitly incorporate matrix metalloproteinases, and I see Bill Gates has done as usual again and screwed up one of the equations, but this is the same equation as before, but now we're not using that explicitly. We now have single cells that migrate through the matrix, and we now have an equation for matrix metalloproteinase, which is now secreted locally by the sprout tips, Ni, which is a Boolean variable. There's some diffusion of that, and there's some natural decay. The fibronectin is now produced by the endothelial cell wherever it is, but also the fibronectin is degraded through the matrix metalloproteinase. So the sprout tips are kind of tunneling through the matrix. They're secreting a protease that's degrading the tissue. And as before, the TAF is taken up by the endothelial cells.
How come there's no diffusion in the tissue angiogenic factor?
Here?
Yeah.
So this assumes that there's an original TAF profile set then, and that will only be degraded.
Yeah,
so
if you're consuming it at various points, won't there be a flux into the regions where it's gone?
Depending upon where the sources are, so our sources assumed to be down here in the domain.
Yeah, but it's consumed in the domain.
It's consumed in the domain, sure. So there will be some, there probably will be some diffusion of this, yeah. Yeah. When we come on to talk about what we're doing with it later, we'll find that it's going to be even worse than that, because as the tumour moves around as well, when we're going to couple this to a tumour, we're going to have various sources moving around all over the place. But yeah, once you degrade it, yeah, you're creating a concentration gradient, I guess, and it'll start to suck towards it.
Ultimately, that degradation doesn't really have any impact, because it's really the tool towards the tumour that's important. So you could remove that if you want.
Have you shown that in the paper?
Yeah, I can show you.
Okay, so this is. So I'm going to show on the left the capillary network, and on the right the enzyme concentrations. Again, red will be high concentrations, and blue will be low concentrations. And as it runs, you can see that the degrading enzymes localize the sprout tips, but diffuses, we get a front. So there's these little valleys that the tips are creating, and this is creating lateral spread and anastomosis. And the color here is just showing the age of the vessels. And for the circular source, there's a small source here. We get a focused pool, all the sprouts degrading the enzyme, a big ditch forming here, if you like, and a very different structure. So the reason that this is done is that MMP is a main target for therapy protocols. So you want to explicitly incorporate that when we want to look at treatment strategies later on. And here's some comparisons with an experiment actually using the earlier model. So this is looking at a more linear source at the bottom and simulation on the right. And this is an upside down, inverse B. So this is a bead here, a pellet here, and more focused growth. So broadly speaking, we pick up the main features. So now I want to incorporate flow in these structures. So this is going back about 4 or 5 years now. So when you look at flow through porous media, so an oil reservoir, unless you're in the Middle East somewhere, isn't a huge pond of oil, as I'm sure you all know. It's the oil's trapped within the rock structure that acts like a huge sponge. And what we're really trying to model, and I was in Crystal Cove at the weekend, and there's some lovely rock structures there to look at, is that we're looking at modelling flow through essentially a cliff that's buried thousands of feet underground. In the petroleum engineering industry, we look at these outcrops and use them as ciphers for what's going on underground, and we map it. And we can map permeability. And you see, this again ties in with the approach that Mary was talking about yesterday, where you've got permeability anisotropy, and you've got these anisotropic tensors, so if you're putting pressure drops in one direction, you can get flow in the orthogonal direction. And this shows you exactly why that's useful in petroleum engineering, because rocks tend to be set down in layered structures. In the petroleum engineering, what we do is we discretize our reservoir into grid blocks, and we have mass balances of oil, water, and gas going in and out. And what we're interested in is how the pressure drop and the flow of each phase are related. So that's what I do most of the time, is to try and figure out what happens at the pore scale to oil, water and gas as it flows through the porous medium. So I'm interested in a much smaller scale. So this is an unconsolidated sandstone. And I reproduce that as an interconnected three-dimensional network of what I call pore elements. So they're shown here as sticks, but they don't need to be, as long as we have a local pressure drop flow relationship. And in fact, now we're in a, you can essentially reconstruct rocks at the pore scale and get a skeleton out from a real rock sample through micro CT, and you can flow through the real structure. And for different types of rock, we could remove some of these pores and look at the effect of reducing connectivity and how that impacts on oil production. And here are just different types of things that we might want to flow through: unconsolidated sandstone, consolidated limestone. And this is a picture I show the students to show them that flow through porous media is not just flow through rocks. Porous media such as bread or flow air through cellulose fibers and see whiskey barrels when you're maturing whiskey is all a very important process. You take, get the sea air. If you leave a whiskey barrel out on an island and the sea air percolates, you can taste the sea air in the whiskey. And this is the human lung. So I showed these sorts of pictures for years to students and never thought for one instance that one day I'd be looking at something like flow through lungs or flow through.
I hope you brought some whiskey for us.
So what we do is we observe the physics in microscopic models, and I really like, if someone's interested, I'd really like to do this with blood in an etched glass network. So what I do is I produce a huge pattern of interconnected pore shapes, and that's photo-reduced, so that something that was kind of this big is just a few centimeters long. So the scale you're looking at here is a couple of hundred microns, so that a glass plate's acid etched, and then another flat plate is put on top to sandwich the pore space. And you put this thing in a rig at 6,000 psi, and you can drop the pressure and see how the dissolved gas comes out of solution. And this is what we're looking at here. We're looking at blue water and pink oil and a white gas bubble that's being liberated from the oil as you drop the pressure. And what we do is we film this. It works. And you'll see this is real time. So as the bubble expanding, as you deplete the oil reservoir, pushing oil, which is pushing a bit of water about. So you fill your car up with gasoline at the gas station. This is where it's come from, and this is the sort of rate that it's come out the ground at in the middle of the reservoir. So things are happening at a very small scale. And what we want to take these microscopic observations and come up with some macroscopic predictions, because the grid blocks in the simulator are large-scale things. So we observe the physics, and then we want to figure out how to flow structures that might be quite complicated in shape. So this is an interconnected 2D network, and we have inlet and outlet pressures. And if you focus on one node, and we assume incompressibility at the moment, then we have flows, some flows going in and some flows going out of that node, and it's just like Kirchhoff's laws for a resistor network. At each point, the flows sum to zero, and you get a huge set of linear pressure equations that you need to solve. So that gives you, because these are all different sized pores, you get a pressure distribution from point to point, and then if you use something like Pazoy's flow, you can calculate the individual flows, you add them all up at the end, and you'll get a total flow rate for a given pressure drop. So that's quite easy for a nice, well-connected, homogeneous network. But you need to use a few tricks when you look at what's really happening. So I'm going to show briefly here. I'll come on to why on earth I'm telling you all of this in a moment. This sounds totally off the subject. This is looking at pressure depletion in an oil system at six different rates. So it's like taking the bottle, the first one's a really fast rate, it's like taking top off a bottle of fizzy water really quickly. And you'll see the white gas bubbles come out, and they're coming out the top. And as you deplete the pressure, the interfacial tension is increasing with pressure. And so you get these elongated ganglia. And what we're interested in is measuring the flow of the white gas and the flow of the red oil as a function of pressure. And as you decrease the rate, you go from something that's gravity dominated to something here, which is capillary dominated. So now the capillary forces are much stronger, and you go from this elongated growth regime to a much more compact growth regime. And this is going to form another feedback into the biological modelling, because to do this you have to track the fusion of gas through these complicated structures and into the gas bubbles. And when we come to look at how the oxygen distribution in a tumour feeds from the vessels, you can see that there's a link there as well. And this is looking at viscous dominated gas flood. So there's oil, gas coming in, oil being produced, and we'll see that at a very high rate we get what's called viscous fingering, that again Mary mentioned yesterday. The sort of thing you might get in the Healy Shore site, and this is the sort of thing you get if you inject a very low viscosity fluid at a high rate. And if you half close your eyes, you can imagine that these structures are tending towards what you might get a blood vessel network looking like. Mm-hmm. And what you're wanting to do is to try and flow through these rather complicated geometries. And there are quite a few tricks that you have to invoke to shut off various pores and numerical problems. And so there's a little bit of thought that needs to go into it, but that's what we're going to do.
So it's fairly that, if you go back to the other slide, on the top and the bottom, it's fairly
quantitative. I can't remember. I can't remember. You'll see when it went. If it went at the top, it'll come in the bottom. Sometimes I close them off top and bottom. So.
The black is
trapped oil. So when you pack your rig up and go home, you've left about 2/3 of the oil behind. So it's an incredibly inefficient process. But as the oil price goes up, as you'll be pleased to see that it has, and the price of petrol is that you're putting in your cars at the moment. Although boy, do you guys have it easy compared to us at the moment. We pay a fortune for our petrol. It becomes more economic to try and get that oil out, because the stuff that you put in to try and get it out comes from oil base. It's an oil-based product. So to get more money for your oil, you can develop these chemicals to put in there and try and shut that off. So what we do now is we take our vascular networks, do you remember these, and we superimpose them on that sort of flow problem. And we've got a very simple algorithm, a single-phase tracer algorithm, which I've called chemotherapy drug. The concentration Cmax is injected at the upstream end of the parent vessel. And at each time step, we calculate the total mass of drug flowing at each node. We can assume perfect mixing, and we can flow out at each node. So we update the concentrations as a function of time. And we're just going to say that if any drug gets within a couple of vessel lengths of my tumour, it's gone. Okay, as simple as that. So this is where, if you listen carefully, you can hear biological people fall off their seats at this point. We treated the capillaries as rigid impermeable cylinders. We treat blood as a Newtonian fluid. So there's no correlation with hematocrit, no reaction kinetics, and the vascular networks too. But apart from that, everything's really realistic. And we ran various suites of simulations. We had the two different vascular types, and we did a continuous infusion. And we took the same vasculatures, and we did a 30-second bolus injection. And we just played around with it. We changed viscosity, and we changed the average capillary radius in the bed to see what happened. So this is just one of the early animations again. So it's going back a bit now. Very quick. Right, okay. So red's high concentration, again, and blue's low concentration. You can see you get breakthrough back into the parent vessel. So the tumour's down here. You get breakthrough back into the parent vessel, so the stuff you're injecting in, a lot of it bypasses the tumour before it gets there and flows downstream again. And lo and behold, if you reduce the blood viscosity, you get more stuff to the bottom boundary quicker. Kind of big deal. It's not linear, because you get quicker breakthrough back into the parent vessel, but it sort of does what I'd said on the tip. If you decrease the viscosity, you'll get stuff there quicker. And lo and behold, if you increase the mean capillary radius, you get the same sort of thing happening. This is continuous infusion into the second vasculature. And now you'll see very rapid breakthrough back to the parent vessel. And very, very poor delivery to the tumour surface. Now this is clearly incredibly well connected here, so we're not saying this is truth or anything, but it's just highlighting the fact that the capillary architecture certainly impacts the amount of drug that you're going to get to the bottom surface. Okay. And finally, bolus injections is a one-off, so you inject as you did before, but then it's chased with clean blood, and you can see that everything gets diluted before it gets anywhere near the bottom boundary. So you get nothing to the tumour surface in this case at all, which is this very interesting line here. So the early findings were that the bolus injection to the network from the circular tap source, the drug bypassed the tumour completely, and we thought this might be of some interest. And we looked at a few simplistic targeting strategies. The motivation for these came from targeting different areas of the vasculature. So we looked at the vasculature and we said, okay, an antivascular drug's fairly broad-based. It might just randomly nuke regions of the vessel. And so we had random removal. Anti-angiogenic treatments tend to target things that hadn't formed a basement membrane, which tend to be the low flow capillaries. And then we thought, what if you could target something like nitric oxide, which would come from areas of high shear, and they would be associated with bottleneck capillaries. So flow through porous media, a lot of the properties are governed by what's called the percolation radius. Mm-hmm. It's a radius on the percolating threshold of a cluster. And this is looking at what happens if you can target high shear vessels. So this is the flow distribution. The black ones are ones that we've knocked out. These are high shear. And if you knock just about 5% of the vessels out, you completely starve the tumour. So it went from this delivery to this. And then we left it at that, because Angelique got a job in France, essentially. But there were quite a lot of limitations, as you know. It was two-dimensional. What happened in 3D? We treated blood as Newtonian fluid. It's not biphasic, and the viscosity is not constant. In reality, the capillaries dilate and constrict. And the capillary architecture, i.e. the topology of the bed, isn't static, it's changing. And let's keep going. We'd only incorporate flow after we'd grown the network. Whereas really, once we've got loops forming, these start to flow. We've looked at growth and flow towards a tumour. What about growth and flow within the tumour, which I'm not going to talk very much about here, and things like tumour cores. So I'm going to show you a very simplistic setup, but of course, different organs, different tumours, the architecture is very different. And what about other limitations? There's no low-pressure venous system. There tends to be venules that rupture. And fill in your own limitations. I'm sure there are hundreds you can think of. So now we begin to relax some of them and see what happens. So the easiest one to do is 3D. Because all the oil core is already working in 3D. Okay. So we've got the tumour surfaces down at the bottom here, we've got a parent vessel on the top, and again we're injecting, we get some breakthrough. And we can track the delivery in 3D. And we thought that bypassing wouldn't be significant in 3D at all, because the 2D stuff was forming a lot of connections just because it was 2D, and that everything would be much better, we'd get much better delivery to the tumour surface in 3D. And it turned out that wasn't the case, so certainly over this time scale. Eventually these will come across, but this is quite a long time scale, 600, 700 seconds. And in 3D, actually, we got less uptake to the tumour surface. And again, if you're familiar with things like percolation theory, there are various percolation thresholds, and we know that it's not just the connectivity of the network that's important to tell you how much fluid goes from one side of a cluster to another, but it's the dimensionality. So you can't just take a cluster in 2D that has an average connectivity of 4, and put that in 3D and expect to get the same results. The dimensionality affects the percolation thresholds. Again, in 3D, we found about 97 to 99% of the drug bypassed the tumour completely. And that was in keeping with what people had found experimentally. So the 3D extension, okay, we found bypassing is just as important. And what about relaxing things like Newtonian flow? So. Okay, so this is a set of capillaries here with red blood cells flowing through them, and you can see that it's quite a complicated system. The blood cells are deforming, it's cleaning up in a nice homogeneous fluid. You get all sorts of interesting things happen at branches. You get plasma skimming, it's called Ferreus effect. The amount of red blood cells you have in the vessel affects the apparent viscosity. The size of the vessel affects that, so called Ferreus-Lindquist effect. And also the whole thing can change dynamically because you get constriction and dilation down here. We'll see flow, and we'll see this just completely shut down through whatever stimulus somewhere else. So we haven't got this nice network that's just flowing to a nice steady state. We have blood rheology, we've got the fact that the capillary radius is a function of the shear stress, and also it turns out the branching probability is a function of the shear stress as well, which we don't have in our model. So we looked through the literature to find out what we could use for our model, and this is what we've used. This comes from Axel Priester's group, and what they did was they took a rat mesentery and they modeled it numerically, and they took averages over about 18 different studies that they've done this on, and they asked themselves the question: what would be the functional form for apparent blood viscosity to match the flows that they measured experimentally in the rat mesentery? And this is the parameterization they came up with, that the apparent viscosity is a function of the radius of the capillary in which the blood's flowing, and also as a function of hematocrit in this very empirical form here. So I'm in no way saying that this is the answer and this holds for everything, but clearly it doesn't. But this is all I have at the moment. If anybody else is aware of anything else that can go in for different network types, it's very easy to just slot that into the model and see what the implications would be. But this is all I'm aware of at the moment. So what we do now is we use a plasmoid type flow, but instead of just having a constant viscosity, we use that parameterization that's being measured experimentally. So the Ferreus-Lindquist effect, which starts up here, high viscosity in a big tube, and comes down, you get a lower apparent viscosity in a small tube. This is looking at the capillary scale, and it starts going back up again. Something else we want to look at is how shear stress affects vessel radii, and again, Priester's group had come up with a formulation that told you how your radii adapted as a function of wall shear stress, transmural pressure, metabolic stimulus, and the shrinking tendency. So we can argue all day about what each of these things are and what these things mean. But this is the parameterization he's come up with, and there's some good physiological evidence for why that might be. So we put this into our model as well. So now what we have is a bit more difficult because the hematocrit radius affects the viscosity, which affects the shear stress, and that affects the radius, which affects the flow, which affects the hematocrit as we propagate through it. So we have to iterate everything until we hit a steady state. So here we're going to look at no blood in the network. We're going to inject at a hematocrit of about 45%, which is an average human value, and then we're going to look to see how the radii adapt. So they all start off with a radius of 6 microns, and we see what happens when we put blood in there. So this is the hematocrit coming in, and the radii start to adapt. So red's big, and green's little, and you pick out a highly conductive flowing backbone. And that settles down to a steady state. And clearly the delivery properties of that are going to be very different compared to homogeneous bed. So that's the first step towards a dynamic model. Hematocrit is the volume percent of the blood that's red blood cells. So only about 45% of it is red blood cells, the rest is plasma, white blood cells, and platelets and stuff like that.
Your radius adaptation is short term smooth muscle or long term remodeling?
Conceptually, it's pretty quick. It's not long term. I mean, this stuff this stuff's remodeling the order of tens of minutes, maybe.
What?
Minutes. Well, let me clarify that. It's tens of minutes when you take a homogeneous bed and try and remodel it, which can't happen physically. But you'll see what happens later. Because it's happening as it's growing, time scales are different. And so I can't answer that question without showing you the last bit. You'll see what happens. So our sprout branching is a function of taff concentration and the age of the vessel. That was the earlier model formulation, so that's the sprout branching. But also we have vessel branching, which depends on the taff concentration and the magnitude of the wall shear stress. So this is, you have to look sort of carefully here to see what happens. Okay, so the vessels are going to grow and it's going to be quite similar. It's just tip branching will happen here. Now if you focus on here, there'll be a connection and you'll see something happen here. So you get vessel branching. When you establish flow away from the parent vessel, you create shear stresses in the structure that can then generate vessel branching. So you have an additional branching mechanism here.
I have a question. If you repeat around, you will get the same thing. I mean, I'm wondering if, like, how, like, what if you run the simulation, like, at a time, you will get the same structure, or you do several runs and you see which one is you take.
So this is one realization that I'm showing.
Okay.
If I take a different random number seed, I get a slightly different structure, but on the global scale, it will look quite similar.
Okay.
You'll see what I mean by global scale. Sorry?
So on average you get on average you will get probably this, for example.
Yes. But you might get a different bit of structure here and stuff, but yeah.
There'll be quantities that will be the same.
Yes.
So recovery curves when you
right.
do this are always
right.
this, depending on certain statistics
right. yeah.
or certain ways of doing
right.
it randomly.
So we have a model for angiogenesis, and we have a model for modeling and rheology. What we want to do is put them together so that everything's happening at the same time. So this is what we've called a dynamic adaptive tumor-induced angiogenesis. So we want to, as I said, we want a model which simultaneously couples the vessel growth with the flow. We want radial adaptations and remodeling to occur as immediate consequences of primary anastomosis, so when things join and start to flow. And we'll find that the capillary architectures are quite different from those that we get when we don't have that dynamic coupling. And again, the modelling rationale is to look at the effects of changing different input parameters and to try and simulate treatments, to try and identify a number of targets. So again, this is very broad-based, and it's just a qualitative look to see what changes you might expect if you change certain parameters. So the procedure is that we migrate the capillaries via the MNP formulation, and initially we only have tip branching because we don't have any flow, and then we can remodel once we have vessel branching and anastomoses. But we have a problem here because the time scale of the cell migrations is the order of days, and the time scale of network perfusion is the order of minutes. So you can't just remodel as you grow. You have to switch timescales. So the idealized procedure would be you model the growth of the network and you stop the migration whenever you get a new loop formed. Then you have to switch timescales, and your new timescale's much smaller because you have to conserve mass at each junction, so that's the minimum over the whole network of V capillary divided by Q capillary. You have to remodel the entire bed, and then you resume growth again. And you can do that because you could solve the pressure field every single time, and when you solve perturbation, it's telling you that something's happened. Mm-hmm. And then you could go and remodel it. When you look at how these things grow, you computationally that would just be too tedious a job to do. It would take a long time, certainly with my PC. So the practical procedure is to flow the network to steady state regularly during the growth process. And we've done some sensitivity to see on average how often you need to do that. Because we'll see later, a lot of these additional loops that form aren't very high flow. They're just adding little bits of dead end stuff. So this is what happens when we just do an a posteriori remodeling. So this is not physical. This is a pre-existing bed that we then flow, and again, red's high and green's very, red's large radius and green's low radius. We pick out this backbone. And when we do the full dynamic simulation, we have the first loop forming here, and we have to flow that to steady state, so that dilates. And then we continue with the growth process, and we finally get additional branches coming off here much earlier than we would otherwise, because the whole thing's dilating and constricting as it's growing. So you get these additional branches, and so the epsilons are going switching time scales. So this flows to this steady state, and then you continue to grow, and you get very different architecture from that than you had before.
When you do the remodeling in response to flow, do you only adjust vessel radii, or do you also consider realignment of vessels, like at junctions?
No, just vessel radii, yeah.
Is that realistic, or can flow also fit across, for instance, a sharp junction to smooth out, or vice versa?
Yeah, I'm sure it possibly could, depending upon the shears that you're generating and stuff like that, yeah. But I haven't looked into that. You're then looking at deformable grid type things and different pressure solvers, and so you could do it. The problem is when you start deforming things and use irregular grids, that your time step can become so small that it just becomes impossible to do anything, because you have to look at flow through something that might be actually quite short.
What I'm asking is, I understand that's one very good reason to not go there. I'm just asking, is there, in experiments, is there any evidence to suggest that there would be any benefit from going through all that effort? I mean, is there any evidence in experiments that those sorts of remodeling events happen?
I don't know of any. But there's not a lot out there that I'm aware of. You know, quantitative, it's hard to do this stuff. You know, lots of things would love people to go and measure, but I understand it's just really hard. Even getting cells moving where you want them to move is hard enough. So. And this is what happens if you increase the sensitivity to shear stress, just playing with some parameters. And if we increase the sensitivity to shear stress, of course, we get more branching. But this dramatically affects the architecture. We get a capillary shunt form. So anything that's injected here is just going to flow through this shunt and out again. Is going to have very poor delivery characteristics associated with it. And we can look at a whole range of sensitivities. We can, again, change the sensitivity differently, change haptotaxis, and there when we reduce haptotaxis, we reduce lateral branching, we get very different backbone structures formed, and that will have very different delivery characteristic compared to a higher haptotactic coefficient. If we change the plasma viscosity, that doesn't have a very large effect. If we increase hematocrit, it doesn't have much of an effect. If we decrease hematocrit, it does. And some of these things are very easy to figure out why they're happening. But other things, it's quite difficult, because once you start putting things into networks, everything's very difficult to try and pick apart. And this is a problem. I was talking to Brian Sleeman about this about a month ago. And he was saying that, you know, it's very difficult to analyze. It becomes impossible to analyze some of these systems when they get so complex. Because what you're essentially doing is numerical experiment. This is, again, the PCs. These are arrows that are going up. So this is increasing blood pressure. So if we increase blood pressure, we get a similar structure. If we just change the inlet or the outlet pressure, you can see we get very different results. So this is decreasing the inlet pressure. So we have much lower shears, so we don't invoke this early branching, and we get a structure that looks similar to an experiment that we've done, numerical experiment, if we've reduced the haptotactic parameter. And so this just highlights one of the issues, that if you're doing an experiment, you could have different things happening, but things look the same, and it can become very difficult to interpret what's actually going on. Because this is a pressure issue, a biochemistry issue, and yet they give architectures that are similar. So if I ran this 100 times and took the averages, they'd look, I get similar numbers out. This is decreasing the outlet pressure, so now we're increasing shears and we start to develop these shunts, and this is changing the sensitivity intravascular pressure. So in the Preece equation is an intravascular pressure stimulus, and we can shut the bed down completely. This won't dilate. Of course, now we have our new networks, so we can flow through them and see what happens to delivery. Now we have this very dilated backbone, things get quite bad, because if we inject something up here, we get flow through the backbone, and we have lots of these little things that are still flowing, but they have very low flows. So we can get stuff to the tumour, but it's going to take a long time. So this is looking at the mass in the vasculature as a function of time, reaches a steady state after about 50 seconds, but it takes about another 200, 250 seconds to get anything to the tumour surface, because it's these low flow capillaries that have to come back there for that architecture, for that particular architecture. But what happens if we look at different architectures, a different model, assumptions? This is the comparison between a homogeneous bed that I showed you at the beginning, where all of the capillaries have the same radius, average radius, and this is what happens in the full dynamic simulation. And this shows that the uptake values are about 3 orders of magnitude bigger for the homogeneous bed compared to when you put the remodeled vasculature in. Because there's no high conductance backbone in the homogeneous network to take everything away. And this just highlights the need for incorporating Bessel adaptations into angiogenesis modeling that are looking at transport issues. This is looking at reducing the effect of epitaxis. We get about this pretty much the same amount of mass in the structures, but spatially distributed very differently. And you see the delivery is radically different here. So the uptake by the tumour is 50 times bigger when we have lateral branching migration and the Bessel branching is reduced. So if we reduce the haptotactic coefficient, we get very different delivery. And this suggests that the tumours that are supplied by that type of vasculature are well supplied with nutrients and could be expected to grow quite quickly, but paradoxically, they would be the most susceptible tumours to treatment because you could get more drug to the tumour. So again, I'm talking very broad terms. I know it's not straightforward as that. There are lots of different ways to treat them. This is just looking at intravascular intra-arterial injection.
These are single injections, not infusions?
They were infusions, but this is over just a time scale of 500 seconds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you did a one-off, it would be much worse than that. The backbone would sweep it out, and you'd get nothing there at all. This is looking at the effect of reducing hematocrit. So this is just playing with the model and seeing, so you can ad nauseum, I'm sure I am going on ad nauseum about the different parameters that you can change and what the impact is on delivery. But this is just showing that if you depress the hematocrit, you can, as I showed you, you've got the formation of these highly dilated arcades close to the parent vessel. So it's a possible mechanism for generating vasculatures that are detrimental to tumour growth. So there's a lot of talk, even in the 70s, about how you might renormalise tumour vasculatures through drug treatment. The theoretical implications for this are that more drug gets into the capillary network than went to the base case simulation, but drug delivery to the tumour is reduced by more than 3 orders of magnitude. So is this trade-off, if you optimise, if you optimise the network using some drug and then go away, you've made it worse because you've actually made it easier for nutrients to get to the tumour. So you should be doing that, but then chasing it with a different drug that will interact in a different way. So anti-angiogenic treatments by themselves, this could be a mechanism for why they clip off all the nice low-flow branches, reduce vascularization, but you've still got that high flow channel to deliver nutrients once you've gone away. So that's often they're given in combination with something.
Since you showed that, you have a nice way to study how flow affects not just the delivery, not just how the network affects delivery to the tumor, but how flow affects the formation of the network. Could you look at the possibility of supplementing an anti-angiogenic treatment with something that regulates blood pressure, say?
Exactly.
So that you could reduce branching, the less branching you get, the less effective the network.
Exactly. Yes, you could. So the next stage with this, I was over talking to Angelique in Grenoble last month. One easy thing to do is you treat the network and then you see how it regrows after you've treated it, because you could have changed the shear distribution then. So depending depending upon how you're, and we're talking to oncologists as to how they think different drugs operate and which part of the vasculature it's destroying. But then go away and then regrow it to see what happens. Does it come back? So other pieces of the puzzle that I'm not going to go into any detail. What about flow within a tumour? So we've got a central tumour here, and the connectivity tends to be quite poor of the vessels inside a tumour. So we can, again, very simplistic, just injecting into two parent vessels. And this is a bolus injection, so the heart, again, the red's high concentration. Once you get drug in there, it can hang around for quite a long time. And different countries have different protocols for how often you schedule a treatment. So the one question is, can you schedule a lot of low-dose treatments more frequently, or should you hit it with less frequent high dose? And this might suggest that if you do a lot of low-dose treatments, a lot of low-dose treatments, you could locally build up a high concentration. If I went away for another few weeks here, this would just go out. It's already diluted. It would just leave the system. And will be very poor treatment. And then we're going to put this together. We're in the middle of putting this together with a tumour model. So instead of having a tumour surface here, we have a tumour that's growing, and the blood vessels going towards it, and nutrient sources changing temporally and spatially. And this is just showing. So we did this, then we had nothing to do with it particularly. We had oxygen coming out of the, or drug or whatever, species A coming out of the vasculature. So here, I've got high transmural permeability here, and I've just shut it off here. But clearly you could play around with that and be more realistic. The idea is to see how you deliver within the tumour oxygen or nutrients. So we're now coupling it to have a transmural diffusion from the blood supply.
So tumour cells could mutate.
Exactly. So that's another scale that if you want to look at something like cellular automaton and how things are mutating, everything's changing. So very simplistically said, the tumour. You know, this thing's changing. It's not just the drug doesn't get there. It's the drug might get there, but the phenotype's changed and the tumour cells don't care. So there's 101 things that's going on here. So conclusions and future work. So I've shown our latest investigation of angiogenesis that incorporates rheological properties and metabolic constraints and vessel branching. We've highlighted a new possible number of possible targets for therapeutic intervention, but we'd like some quantitative data, and I know this is very difficult to get. Things like manipulating the sensitivity to wall shear, modulating the haptotactic response, changing hematocrit and blood pressure. And again, maybe not doing those in isolation. We find that this explicit coupling of the growth and flow gives us very different network architecture from those that we had in our previous models and other previous models. We get these dilated loops that form very early close to the parent vessel. This is positively reinforcing. What happens is that the dilated capillaries undergo further vessel branching, and so you get this brush border effect close to the tumour surface because of the subsequent migration of these branches. And this means that the number of high conductance pathways is greatly reduced close to the surface of the tumour. So that network structure plays a vital role, and the connectivity of that network plays a role in delivery. And finally, we hope that the model is going to provide us with a useful framework to examine the possibility of managing this backbone, what things affect it. Again, very broad terms, but just to highlight different things that people could go and look at. So future work, as I say, we're in the middle of coupling this to continuum and cellular automata models. So it's very easy to say, not easy to do. We'd like to look at some real vasculatures. So again, Grenoble has a lot of these things. We can then go on to look at metastasis. This is your wish list. Heterogeneous tissues that we kind of heard about yesterday. And then lots of other applications. Different words for different grant proposals. Lymphangiogenesis, therapeutic wound healing or retinopathy. So I'll stop there. Thanks.